Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's February 21st, and we're going to finish up Chapter 6 and then zoom into Chapter 3 today. Hopefully that's what we're going to do. Does anybody have any questions? No questions? Fantastic. All right, so let's see. I've got 11:22, but my watch is just a little bit fast. All right, so listen up, you guys. Okay, yes, question. Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to start lecturing on this slide right here, but I want to go over a couple of things first. It might come time this semester that I'm going to lock that door at 11:20. Okay, so don't be late to class. Okay, because it might become the administration has asked me to do that on opening day. All right, just as a security precaution. And, I might elect to do that. I might not. We'll just see. So don't be late to class. If you have to be late to class, then maybe you should talk to me and we can work something else out. All right. Okay, so on the screen, let me work with the lights. On the screen, we see the schedule on the right-hand side. And let's just look at the schedule. So today is 21st. Yeah, we did have that disaster drill today, so we're going to finish up Chapter 6, Interactions Between Cells. So we're just a little bit ahead of schedule, which is okay, which means that we have a lot of time for questions before that first exam, because we still have to cover Chapter 3 before the first exam. And the first exam is a week and a half from today. It's on a Tuesday. Right, and today's Thursday, I believe, yeah. So, and that is on March 5th. The chapters are 1, 2, 3, and 6. All right, so please don't tell me that you don't know what chapters are on the exam, because it's on the recorder as well. Okay, so chapters 1, 2, 3, and 6 on March 5th. Okay, let's look at the slides for today's lecture. And did anybody get out their calculator and work with these calculations, work with this equation right here? And did anybody find either of these wrong? Are either of these, did they give you a different number on your calculator? Okay, so the equilibrium potential for potassium I see is minus 90 millivolts, but the equilibrium potential for sodium is plus 60 millivolts. And so that tells you that the potassium and sodium are on opposite sides of the membrane because they're producing opposite voltages, but they're both cations, right? If they had opposite, if one was a cation, one was an anion on the same side of the membrane, it would produce an opposite voltage. But since they're both cations, they have to be on opposite sides of the membrane to produce a different equilibrium voltage. All right, so on this slide, I said for sure you should know what the concentration of these four ions is across the membrane. One side should be high, the other side should be low. And I said you didn't have to memorize the numbers. You should just know the magnitude so you understand what the concentration gradient was. So that if for some reason this membrane became permeable to these ions right here, they would move just by diffusion. And how would sodium move? Here's that phospholipid bilayer. Sodium can't get through that membrane because of this hydrophobic region in the center of the membrane. Which way would sodium move if all of a sudden we put a channel or a tunnel through this membrane? Which way would it move? It would move down the concentration gradient into the cell. What about potassium? Which way would it move? Okay, it would move just by concentration gradient, right, from inside to outside. What about chloride? From outside to inside. And this is really what I wanted to talk about. Calcium, right? Which way would it move? From outside to inside. Plus, I want you to know something else. What's the concentration of calcium inside this normal cell? Let's just say this is a normal cell right here. It's what? 0.0001 millimolar, which is extremely small. Basically, it's a zero concentration. Normally, we find no calcium inside the cell under resting conditions. All right, so I think that's going to be an important concept today later on, or in the next chapter. Right. So that's important. Now, what kind of ion is calcium? You believe it's an ion? Yeah, how do you know? It's got an electrical charge by it. And what kind of ion is that? Bivalent. I'm hearing something I like. Bivalent. What kind? Cation. Right, bivalent cation. Okay, so if we were going to put this into the Nernst equation, what would we have to put in for Z, for calcium? You'd have to put a 2 right here instead of a plus 1. All right, for sodium, there's a plus 1 right here. Why is that? Because it's a cation, and it's just a monovalent cation. Right, so we just put the valence number down in this denominator, and 61 is going to be identical for all ions that we're considering. Okay, on this slide, we just said that typically the resting membrane potential in an average typical cell, we're going to define it to be 70 millivolts, actually minus 70 millivolts, which is pretty much right in the range of what we find most cells. Okay, and I think we left off probably on this slide right here. And this slide right here just shows the sodium-potassium ATP pump. Okay, and when I say pump, what does that mean when we look at this diagram? It's missing something. If it's a pump, what should we also have on this diagram if we want to be more complete? ATP, right? Because it's a primary active transport transporter, right? So that's what any kind of pump is. And you can see that it doesn't transport potassium and sodium in the same direction, number one, and number two, there's an unequal number of ions that are transported across the membrane. Right? So potassium, two potassiums enter the cell for every three that leave. So two positive charges enter the cell every time three positive charges leave the cell. So what does that do to the cell right here? What does that do to the resting membrane potential? If you're kicking out more positive charges, what happens to the inside of the cell? It becomes more negative, right? So this also adds to the resting membrane potential. That's just another item that, oh, it says right here on the slide. All right, so that does contribute to the resting membrane potential. Here is a synopsis of all the things that we've looked at. And it just kind of lists some of the things that contribute to resting membrane potential, which we're going to just say is minus 70 millivolts in most cases. All right, so let's start with a cell with DNA and other proteins trapped inside the cell. They can't leave because they're way too big, and they all have negative charges on them. So we're going to call these anions. So there's this big fixed concentration of anions inside the cell. And so that makes the cell, what, negative on the inside because of that. All right, and because it's negative on the inside, potassium wants to enter the cell, and sodium wants to enter the cell to neutralize those electrical charges. And what we see right here, sodium can't really enter the cell, but potassium can because there are some channels specifically put into the membrane. So potassium can enter the cell, and that permeability, the leaking of potassium, affects the membrane voltage, the resting membrane potential. And we didn't really talk about that. We just said in this class, if we adjust the permeability of a membrane to a particular ion, that's going to change the membrane potential. Okay, so that's just one thing we have to keep in the back of our mind, because we're going to see permeabilities change later on in the class. And also because of the sodium-potassium pump, potassium is higher on the inside than the outside, and sodium is higher on the outside than the inside. That also contributes to the resting membrane potential, right? And we could calculate by the Nernst equation what the equilibrium potentials are. But remember, we can't just add those voltages up because it doesn't make sense because we're ignoring permeability, all right? And we're ignoring these fixed ions right here. But nonetheless, that produces an uneven distribution of ions across the membrane. And here is that Nernst equation calculation, minus 90 millivolts for potassium, plus 66 millivolts for sodium. And we can't just add these two numbers together because there are many more considerations that have to be factored in, have to be added or subtracted to these voltages to get what the real world voltage is. But I do want you to appreciate what some of these other factors are. It's not so important that you know how to calculate the effect, all right? So it's important for you to be able to calculate the equilibrium potential for one ion at a time, but not all ions together, right, at a particular time. So we just know empirically in this class that RMP is going to be equal to minus 70 millivolts. And what that means is, where do we find the, where's this negative number, inside or outside? Yeah, it's inside the cell. So the inside of the cell is, has a negative potential compared to the outside of the cell with this magnitude right here, 70 millivolts. All right, so that's all we're going to say about resting membrane potential for a little bit. So you need to spend some time with it this weekend, and you got to ask me some questions next week, and your SI leader, your lab instructors, because I'm sure you've never thought about electricity before or electrical charges when you talked about when you studied biology. But it's really important, okay, because every cell in our body acts as a battery. We're very electrical. All right, so let's change the topic a little bit and talk about how cells can communicate with each other. And that's, of course, very important because we have billions of cells inside our body, and we want all those cells to behave, right? Like, come to physiology class and take notes, right? So you want to be in control, and your body wants to be in control of all of these cells. Okay, so here is a good concept that I want you to know. The structural and functional unit of communication between cells, which is just how cells talk to each other, is what we're going to call a synapse. So in order for cells to communicate or talk to each other, we're going to think in terms of a synapse. But maybe you don't know what that means because we haven't defined what a synapse is. But so now we're going to talk about a synapse to know something about what is necessary for cell signaling. There are two general types of synapses in your body. And your book doesn't do a really good job of this, but this is how I organize it in my mind. So it's probably pretty good that you appreciate that, because who writes the tests? Yeah, I do, right? So this is a good hint. Okay. So there are two kinds of synapses. There are electrical synapses and chemical synapses. By far the most important in our body are chemical synapses. Electrical synapses are really crucial, but only in a few tissues. For instance, like in the heart. So let's take a look. So the first one we're going to look at is an electrical synapse. And here I see two cells. There's a top cell and a bottom cell. And you can see this membrane right here, which has that lipid region in the very center. So this is going to exclude polar compounds or electrolytes from moving back and forth. Okay. So if we open up this channel, and this is going to, let's just say this is a sodium channel, what is sodium going to want to do? Or what will sodium do if this channel opens up right here? Where is it at a high concentration? It's outside the cell. Will it want to diffuse inside the cell? Absolutely, because of the concentration gradient. What about the electrical gradient? What's the charge inside the cell? Negative. What's the charge on sodium? Positive. And what can you tell me about opposite charges? They attract each other. So there's another reason why sodium wants to enter the cell, right, to help neutralize the electrical charges. All right, when sodium enters a cell, we call that an excitation. That's an excitatory event. That's going to change the membrane potential, and the cell is going to change its behavior as a result of that. So when sodium enters, that's excitation with this top cell. But sodium can only enter if there is a channel that's open. So sodium, when it's in high concentration, would like to get into this neighboring cell over here, but usually it can't because there are some membranes in the way. Sodium can't just hop from one cell to another, except if it has a gap junction. These are special proteins that are inserted between two cells within the membrane, and it's a pathway for sodium. Sodium can slip through a gap junction. All right, so when the top cell is excited, namely when sodium enters and becomes a high concentration, what does sodium want to do with this bottom cell down over here? It wants to get in there too because it's negative and it's very low concentration in sodium. So sodium then can enter this bottom cell. And then what happens to the bottom cell? Does it become inhibited or excited? Okay, whenever sodium enters the cell, you're going to understand that to be an excitatory event. So the top cell becomes excited, and then that excites the bottom cell as well. And we call this an electrical synapse because what is really flowing from one cell to another? It's an electrical charge, which is really an electrical current. Okay, so this is what we call an electrical synapse. And in order for that to happen, these cells have to be touching each other and there have to be gap junctions between them. If there are no gap junctions, if we excite the top cell, the bottom cell is going to be isolated and will not be excited. Nothing's going to change in the bottom cell. All right. And as a matter of fact, extend this concept a little bit. Instead of two cells right here, let's put a million cells, and they all have gap junctions between them. All we have to do is excite one cell, and what happens to those millions of cells? Yeah, they all get excited in unison, because sodium can go from one cell to another, to another, to another, to another. All right, so that's kind of the beauty of these gap junctions. Okay. So which type of synapse is a gap junction? We're going to call that an electrical synapse. All right, so no paracrine, no neurotransmitter is being transported from one cell to another. It's just that sodium is going to move through these gap junctions. All right, here's another form of cell signaling. I see two different kinds of tissues right here. Maybe these are muscle cells, maybe smooth muscle cells, and maybe this is a neuron. Okay, this may be just one way of thinking of it. And this top tissue wants to coordinate some activity in the bottom tissue. And it can do that by producing some kind of product and releasing that product. And it's going to move from high concentration by the top cells down to the bottom cells. Right? So this signaling molecule is going to move just by diffusion. And it can control the activity of these cells. Okay, but what do these cells down over here have to have in order to be sensitive to this signaling compound or this signaling molecule? What do you have to have so that you can see light? You need photoreceptors or eyes, right? So all cells have to have a receptor for these particular kinds of signaling compounds. And if the signaling compound diffuses over a short distance, then we call that a paracrine agent. Paracrine just means near. So it's a signaling compound that could go from cell to cell or maybe across a very narrow junction between two different kinds of tissues. And so this signaling compound is basically a secretion from these paracrine cells. And it's then going to control these cells if they have a receptor. If there's no receptor, what's going to be the response to the signaling compound? No response whatsoever, right? It's just completely going to ignore that signal. All right, so what must a target cell contain in order to respond to a signal molecule? You're going to feel like I'm beating this into you, but that's okay. What does it got to have? A receptor. Okay, what must be the shape of the binding site on the paracrine receptor? It's got to be complementary to the shape of the paracrine signaling molecule, right? So if the paracrine regulator is shaped like a hand, what does the shape of the receptor have to be on these cells down over here? It has to be like a glove so they can fit together. Sometimes you actually call that the lock and key understanding of how receptors work. That's maybe another good model that you could have in your mind. A key will only work in the lock if it has what? The correct shape, which is going to be complementary to the lock. Okay. All right, so this kind of synapse is what we call a chemical synapse because this paracrine agent right here is not charged. It does not have an electrical charge. So there's no electrical current that moves from one cell to another. It's just a transport of this chemical across some kind of extracellular space. So this is what we're going to call a chemical synapse. So a chemical synapse has a cell that secretes a paracrine agent and other kinds of cells or other kinds of tissues that have receptors. And as a result of that, these cells can communicate with each other. And usually it's a one-way communication from one cell to another. So it could go the other way, but there's going to be a different kind of paracrine agent, which means then that these cells up over here have to have a different what? A different receptor than the receptor that you find in this tissue down over here. Okay, here's another kind of synapse. Here we have a neuron, and what does this cell look like to you? Muscle. All right, you remember some anatomy, really good. So this, why do you say muscle cell? Because I see all these striations right here, and maybe you can remember that as being sarcomeres that line up from end to end on this muscle fiber. We call this a muscle fiber because skeletal muscle cells are long and narrow. They actually look like a fiber. They don't have any branching to them whatsoever. All right, so here we have some tissue up over here, let's say in the brain, and it wants to tell the skeletal muscle to contract. And your body wants it to happen in this kind of speedy fashion. So the distance between this neuron and this muscle fiber could maybe be a couple feet or maybe even a meter. And that's way too far for diffusion to take place, right? So the previous slide mechanism wouldn't work for this example at all because it would take forever for that molecule to diffuse to a muscle, and by that time you wouldn't even want to contract that muscle anymore. So what happens is this neuron carries an electrical signal all the way down this axon, okay, down to where we find the skeletal muscle. When the electrical signal reaches this axon terminus, it causes the release of a chemical from the neuron, and it diffuses across this little space between the neuron and the muscle. We call that the neuromuscular junction. And then it's going to control the activity of this muscle. Namely, it's going to cause contraction. Because what does this muscle have? Why is it possible for this neurotransmitter to cause this muscle to contract? What does this muscle cell have to have? It's got to have a receptor for it, right? Okay, so this is what we call a chemical synapse, once again, because this neurotransmitter, right, is what's used to transfer information or transmit information from one cell to another. No gap junction. Electricity is not used. And we call this a neurotransmitter because it is secreted by what kind of cell? A neuron. It's a paracrine agent still because it travels a very short distance, but it's a special kind of paracrine agent that we recognize as a neurotransmitter. Okay. When the neurotransmitter binds to the muscle cell, right, we get an electrical event very similar to the electrical event that occurred on this axon. So information is transmitted over a neuron as an electrical signal, and then it's converted into a chemical signal, and the chemical signal then gets converted into what when it reaches this muscle cell? Gets converted back into an electrical signal. All right, so I see three parts to this diagram. I see the axon, I see the neuromuscular junction, and I see the muscle cell. And so what you should appreciate is in the axon, there is an electrical event that is occurring. Within the neuromuscular junction, then it's converted into a chemical event, namely this neurotransmitter. And then within the muscle cell, that neurotransmitter then initiates another electrical event that sweeps over this whole muscle cell, causing it to contract. Okay, so we got electrical event, chemical event, electrical event. And because there's a chemical in the neuromuscular junction, what kind of synapse do we call this? Electrical or chemical? It's a chemical synapse because that paracrine agent, namely this neurotransmitter, is being used to transmit information. And again, it's really just a one-way street across the synapse. And that is, and you should probably think about that maybe for a couple days, why is information only going from this axon to this muscle? Because just according to this diagram right here. There's two reasons that I see. Number one, you see right off the bat, and that's because this axon terminus does not have receptors for a signaling compound, right? So if it's blind to this neurotransmitter, it cannot see that it has a high concentration. Where are the receptors located? Only in the muscle, okay? Only in these muscles right here. That's one reason. The other reason is that this muscle is not secreting a paracrine agent, right? So there's no way for this muscle to talk to this neuron because it's not secreting any kind of paracrine agent. So it's not, the muscle is not secreting, number one. Number two, there's no receptor on the axon terminus to receive a signal, even if the muscle was sending some kind of signal. All right, so what must be the shape of the binding site of the neurotransmitter receptor? Where do you find the neurotransmitter receptor? On the muscle cell. And what must be the shape of that receptor? It's got to be complementary to the shape of that neurotransmitter. And if you change the shape of the neurotransmitter, it can't bind to the receptor and it won't change the physiology inside that muscle cell. Okay, here's another way that cells can't communicate with each other. Oh, this one here. This signal travels very fast, Okay, and so this is for a very quick response. When some system, pretty much any system in your body, if it responds quickly, the duration is usually a very short period of time. Right? If there's a very quick onset of some effect, the effect will persist for only a short period of time, which is what we have right here. Right? So as soon as we stop sending electrical impulses down the axon, what happens to that muscle cell? It relaxes. Okay? Because that's just the nature. That's just nature in general. Here's another kind of signaling system. Right? So this is what we call endocrine signaling. So here we have a bunch of cells. And maybe you could tell me something about these cells right here. It's a gland. What kind of cells, what kind of tissue makes up a gland usually? Yeah, I just want to wake up some cells from anatomy in your brains. Remember, it's epithelium. Epithelium makes glands. And so here is a gland that produces a product, and that it releases a product when it wants to communicate with some other cells. And these cells can be at a distant, way distant location in the body. So this product right here gets placed into this blood vessel, and when it's in the blood vessel, where does it go? Not to just one cell, like the previous example, but all over your body, right? Because blood goes everywhere in your body. So that signaling compound goes everywhere in the body. Now, how does this signaling compound get into the blood? What kind of blood vessel is this? A capillary, because only in capillaries can exchange take place with this extracellular fluid, because capillaries are really thin, and they may even have some holes in them. Arterioles, arteries, venules, veins are way too thick to allow for exchange. Right? So once this compound enters a capillary and gets into, you know, either a vein or an artery or anything, it can't leave. It's trapped because the wall of those vessels are way too thick. So then it's going to go to another capillary in some other location in the body. And what can the signaling compound do when it's in another capillary? It can diffuse out, right? Because the capillary is specialized for exchange. And these cells over here can respond to these hormones if they have what? If they have a receptor. If these cells have a receptor for this hormone, then we call this a target tissue or a target organ, right? So what does a target tissue have or a target organ have that makes it special? If it has receptors, right? Okay, so this is what we call endocrine signaling, because these glandular cells right here secrete their signaling compound not into a duct that will carry it someplace, but into the blood. So that's a characteristic of a hormone, right? A hormone is distributed in the body by the cardiovascular system, not by some kind of duct. Now, there are glands that have ducts, salivary glands, really good example. What kind of gland is that? We just talked about an endocrine gland. What's another kind of gland that secretes a product into a duct? Exocrine gland. Maybe another good example would be, for instance, the pancreas. When it produces digestive enzymes, it doesn't want to secrete those digestive enzymes into the extracellular space, right? It wants to secrete them directly into your intestines. And so there is a pancreatic duct that takes those enzymes right there. Okay, so an endocrine system is one that has an endocrine gland, meaning it's a ductless gland, secretes its product into the blood, which carries it to a distant target tissue, which has a receptor, and when it binds to receptor, it's going to elicit a specific response. That's the last most important, and another important thing. Right? When the hormone binds to receptor, it's going to change the physiology of this cell. Right? So that's a typical endocrine signaling system. What must be the shape of the binding site of the hormone receptor? Complementary. Here we have a nice circular one, and here I can see the receptor as kind of being circular as well. Okay. Now, there can be different kinds of signaling molecules. Oh, and guess what? Is this a chemical synapse or an electrical? An example of a chemical synapse. It's chemical because the information, right, is being transmitted by a chemical, not a current of sodium or potassium or some other kind of ion. All right, so let's look at some signaling molecules. In particular, hydrophobic regulatory molecules. And if something is hydrophobic, where does it like to exist? In a lipid layer or in a water compartment, if it's hydrophobic? Hates water, afraid of water, right? So it wants to be in oil, which means then that that particular compound can diffuse right across the membrane because it's happy to do so because this interior part of the membrane is a lipid. So hydrophobic regulatory molecules, if they're outside the cell, can move right into the cell, and so they have to have receptors in the cytoplasm. Hydrophobic regulatory molecules have cytoplasmic receptors, not receptors on the outside of the cell, but on the interior of the cell, and maybe even sometimes within the nucleus. And a good example of that is a steroid, because what class of biochemicals is a steroid? What do we got? We got carbohydrate, protein, lipid, nucleic acid. It's a lipid, right? So it can diffuse right through this membrane over here, and it will bind to cytoplasmic receptors. Thyroid hormones are lipid-soluble as well. They can move right into the cell. And nitric oxide, which is a gas, can move right in as well. Just like oxygen can diffuse in and carbon dioxide can diffuse out. When a signaling compound binds to this receptor, the cytoplasmic receptor, it's usually going to affect the physiology, change the physiology of the nucleus, and it's going to activate some genes. When a gene is activated, it usually produces a protein. Right, so when this signaling molecule binds to receptor, this cell is going to produce a different kind of protein. And these proteins have different shapes, which then does what to the cell? Changes, what's happening inside the cell when these different proteins are made. All right, so we got hydrophobic regulatory molecules with cytoplasmic receptors. What's another class? You got hydrophobic, then we have to talk about hydrophilic. So here we have hydrophilic. And what kind of compartment does a hydrophilic molecule like to be in? Water or lipid?
Water,
like we have in the extracellular space. But even more importantly, a hydrophilic molecule cannot get through the cell membrane because of this phospholipid bilayer, right? It's stuck outside the cell. All right, so if this signaling molecule is stuck outside the cell, how's it going to change the physiology inside the cell? Well, it has to bind to a receptor, number one, and where does that receptor have to be? It's got to be outside the cell someplace. So here's an example of a receptor, right, that is on the outside of the cell. Here is the receptor site, and it matches the shape of the signaling compound. But this protein actually, spans the whole width of this membrane. So when a signaling compound binds to a plasma membrane receptor, which is outside the cell, this protein can change what's happening inside the cell because it goes all the way through the membrane. Right? And so this compound never enters the cell. But when this receptor is bound, okay, it's going to cause the development of other messengers inside the cell. And those are what we're going to call second messengers. The first messenger is what binds to the plasma membrane receptor, and then that's going to increase the concentration of some other kind of molecule inside the cell. And we're going to learn about what some of those molecules are and some nifty pathways by how that happens. Okay, so where do you always find the first messenger? Outside the cell, because they can't get in. Where do you find the second messenger? Always inside the cell, right? Because of this signaling molecule binding to this receptor. So this is a scheme for a hydrophilic regulatory molecule. Here is an example of some second messengers. And where do you find a second messenger again all the time? Inside the cell, right? When it gets inside the cell, it's going to change the physiology inside the cell. So ions can do that, especially calcium, right? When calcium enters the cell or floods the cytoplasm of a cell, it's going to drastically change the physiology of the cell. And does that make sense? Because a cell at rest, what's the concentration of calcium inside the cell? It's basically zero, very, very low concentration. But if a certain receptor is stimulated by binding a hormone or some other kind of signal, then calcium can flood the inside of the cell, and that can be a very important signal if calcium concentration rises inside the cell, because normally it is zero. So calcium would be a good second messenger, right, if it enters a cell, right? And that would be a good definition of a second messenger. Here is a compound that we call cyclic AMP. AMP comes from ATP. You've probably heard of ATP. We'll look at its structure in a little bit more detail, but it has three phosphates. ATP has three phosphates. And if we chop off two of them, guess what we have left? Adenosine monophosphate. And adenosine monophosphate can exist in a linear form or a circular form. If it's in a circular form, we call it cyclic AMP. It has a different shape than the linear form, and that cyclic shape can be a very important second messenger inside the cell. All right, I'm going to skip G protein for just a second and get back to it. Here is something that you're just going to call DAG, a diacyl glycerate. You don't really have to know what it is, but when it is built up inside the cell, that can change the physiology inside the cell as well. So in a couple chapters, maybe toward the end of the class, we're going to talk about DAG. At the same time, we're going to talk about IPI3, right? That's inositol 3-phosphate, but you don't have to really know the name. Just know these abbreviations right here. Okay, that's important. All right, let's get back to G proteins. G proteins are not really second messengers. This is a little bit of a misnomer, but G proteins are an integral part of a signaling system that can produce these second messengers. All right, so I can see why some people like to think that a G protein is a second messenger, but a G protein really does not enter the cell. It just allows these other second messengers to become high concentration inside of a cell. So a G protein can convert ATP into cyclic AMP, and cyclic AMP then is going to float around in the cytoplasm. That's a second messenger, not the G protein. We got a nice diagram to look at, which is almost the next slide. Okay, so let's talk about these G proteins. They're part of a second messenger system. All right, so what kind of signaling compound is going to work through a second messenger system? Hydrophilic or hydrophobic? Hydrophilic, right? One that can't get inside the cell. And it's going to utilize this G protein scheme to develop a second messenger inside the cell. A G protein has 3 subunits. And these are proteinaceous in nature. They're proteins, mostly made out of proteins. And these 3 subunits are always found on the inner surface of the cell. And they're kind of attached to that surface. They can't get out. They can't jump around inside the cell. Okay. And when they become activated, right, these subunits break apart and float around on the inside of the cell, the inside membrane surface of a cell, and those subunits can then activate different other kinds of proteins that are in the membrane. And we're going to talk about a number of these different kinds of schemes. Maybe one of these subunits, right, will then bind to a channel that is normally closed, and when it binds to that channel, it's going to open. And if that channel happens to be a sodium channel, what's going to happen? What is sodium going to do? Where is sodium at a high concentration? Outside, and then what's going to happen? When that channel opens, it's going to rush inside the cell. Okay? And when it rushes inside the cell, what do we want to consider that? Is that excitatory or inhibitory? Yeah, in this class we're going to recognize that as always an excitatory event, excitatory signal. Alright, so let's take a look at this. This is an exam figure. This is the last figure in this chapter. And I see a nice phospholipid bilayer. And I see a protein that spans the whole membrane. Part of it is on the extracellular side. Part of it is on the intracellular side. And here we have a regulatory molecule that's binding to a receptor that is on the extracellular space, right? So it's outside the cell. So what can you tell me about this regulatory molecule? What's some of its physical chemistry? It is hydrophilic. Right? And if it's hydrophilic, it can't get through the membrane, so it's got to have an external receptor, external to the cell. So when it binds to this receptor, right, it will then affect this G protein. And a G protein has these 3 subunits, like we mentioned on the previous slide, and we just named them alpha, beta, gamma, or 1, 2, 3. That's fine. And we call this a G protein because this alpha subunit can bind guanosine triphosphate. That's another nucleotide very similar to ATP. And what do you understand ATP to be in your body? Energy. GTP is really the same thing. It's an energy source. But it's not used in a lot of systems. Most systems use ATP. But here's one as an example where ATP is not being used for energy. So when this regulatory molecule binds to the receptor, a used up GTP in the form of GDP is released, And now the binding site for guanosine triphosphate opens up, and a guanosine triphosphate can bind to this alpha subunit. When GTP binds to the alpha subunit, then dissociation takes place. So here we see this alpha subunit all by itself with a GTP molecule, and the beta and gamma are still associated, and I've never really seen them dissociate. So usually beta and gamma separate from the alpha, and they go their separate ways. Right? And they can diffuse around on the inner surface of the membrane. They just have that particular property where they're just glued to the inner surface of this membrane. This alpha unit can move laterally or, you know, up and down, can't get out of the cell, and the beta gamma unit can move around on the inside of the cell. And when it moves around on this membrane, it can bump into other proteins that are embedded in the membrane. And this is what we're going to call an effector. This effector could be, what I just mentioned, maybe a membrane channel that opens up. Or it could be a membrane channel that closes when it binds this beta-gamma subunit. Right? Or this effector could be an enzyme that catalyzes a reaction. And maybe it's an enzyme that can take ATP and convert it into cyclic AMP. And now we have cyclic AMP inside the cell. What are we going to call that? Cyclic AMP inside the cell. What's this outside the cell? Outside the cell is the first messenger. Cyclic AMP, now that's being produced because this enzyme has been activated, cyclic AMP is what we call a second messenger. Yeah, cyclic AMP is a second messenger. Or maybe some other enzymes in the membrane can be activated that are going to synthesize DAG or IPE3, which then are second messengers, which will have different effects. Okay. So these two subunits can change these effectors in the cell membrane, maybe allowing calcium to enter the cell or producing cyclic AMP or some of these other metabolites like IPE3 and DAG. And then after a certain period of time, they dissociate from the effectors and they bump into GDP. Right, when these beta and gamma bump into this alpha subunit back at this receptor, which no longer has a signaling molecule on it, that's when GTP is hydrolyzed, inorganic phosphate is released, and that reactivates this whole system once again. Right? And so now this receptor can bind to a signaling compound and this cycle can repeat itself over and over and over again, taking an extracellular signal, creating an intracellular signal across the membrane. All right, so this is what we call the G protein. This is the receptor. And usually we say this is a G protein coupled receptor. G protein coupled, because here is the G protein, and that's coupled to the receptor that goes across the membrane. The G protein is just glued to the bottom of this membrane right here. Okay, this will make a whole lot more sense when we can talk about some specific examples. We'll talk about some specific examples of this G protein coupled receptor in a number of chapters. All right, this is just a nice simple introduction to it so that when I mention it again next time, it won't be just totally strange. Okay? All right, so that's it for this chapter. Yeah. I don't think anybody really knows exactly how it becomes inactivated, why it's released from the effector, but it probably is due to the law of mass action, which just says that if you have a lot of if you have a chemical reaction, like A and B, if you have a lot of A, it's automatically going to flow into B. Okay? Or if you have equal numbers of A and B and you take away B, then A is going to flow into B. And the reverse can take place. All right, so if that activated G protein goes down in concentration, then part of it is going to dissociate from the effector and then stop the effect from happening. It recharges it again and it can go through that cycle again. Oh, there was something I forgot to mention. All right, and that is, I think, on this slide right here. Yeah, I forgot to mention. All right, so this action of a neurotransmitter is very rapid. So what's the duration of this neuron controlling the skeletal muscle cell if the action is very rapid? Short, for a short period of time. Okay. Now here's a signaling system, this endocrine system, where it takes a long time for this endocrine gland to secrete a hormone into the blood, and then it's got to travel around in the blood, leave the blood vessel, bind to receptor. It takes a lot longer time for that to happen. But what would you guess the duration of that action is? It's for a long time, right? So short-term regulation in the body works through nervous systems or reflexes. Long-term regulation in the body uses endocrine signals. Right? It takes longer to control things, but the duration is a lot longer as well. Okay, and you're just going to recognize that in all kinds of different physiologic systems and pharmacologic systems. All right, so here is 6. Where do we want to go next? Chapter 3. Which is going to be a nice review, I think, for most of you. We've talked about a lot of this stuff already in anatomy. So I'm going to hit on some important points. So we're going to talk about cells, right? Cell structure and genetic control. And we're going to start with talking about the membrane. We talked about the plasma membrane a lot already in this class, but we're going to talk about it some more. We'll talk about organelles, how genes are expressed. And then we're going to talk about protein synthesis once again. Okay? And we're going to relate it to some organelles inside the cell. So here we have an illustration of a cell. And it's not quite as good as the one that you have in your anatomy book, because your anatomy book sometimes has microvilli and cilia on it. And we talk about those in this class, but unfortunately I don't have a good diagram of it. But I could import one from your anatomy book, but I think you have pretty good memory. So here's a cell. And a cell, let's define what a cell is. A cell has to have an outer membrane right here, a cell membrane or a plasma membrane. And number 2, it's got to have cytoplasm. Cytoplasm is just different than the extracellular space. It contains a bunch of enzymes and other biological kinds of processes that are happening inside the cell. And the third thing that a cell has to have is genetic material. Here we see the nucleus with chromosomes or chromatin in it, right? And that is a way that information can be passed from this parent cell to its daughter cells if it undergoes mitosis, right? So that's how information is transmitted. If a particle doesn't have a plasma membrane, cytoplasm, and genetic material, then it's not a cell. And we're going to define life, and everybody does. Life is cellular. In order for something to be alive, it's got to be made out of cells with those three components to it. If it's missing one of those components, then it's not a cell. And if it's not a cell, can it be alive? Nope, can't be alive. All right. And if it's not alive, can you kill it? No. Okay, that's going to be an interesting thing that we look at later on. Okay, so here on this slide, it's a little bit misleading. Okay, a cell has a plasma membrane that we talked about, cytoplasm. Cytoplasm really should be defined as, and you should note this on your slide, cytoplasm is made out of cytosol, which is the fluid part inside the cell, and also all of these other particles that we call organelles. So cytoplasm is cytosol plus organelles. That's what cytoplasm is. Okay, so organelles is really a part of cytoplasm. So I see a number of organelles inside the cell. I'll quickly point them out to you. Here's the plasma membrane. We want to consider that an organelle. Here is mitochondria that make ATP. Here's the nucleus that protects genetic material so it doesn't get disturbed. Then I see some rough endoplasmic reticulum, and your book loves to call it something else. Granular. Okay, granular endoplasmic reticulum. Granular because it's rough endoplasmic reticulum. And you should know why it's rough, because all these little dots right here are what we call ribosomes. And a ribosome is just another organelle. So if we take smooth endoplasmic reticulum that we see over here and add ribosomes to it, all right, we're going to change the shape. What are we going to do to the function of this smooth endoplasmic reticulum when we change its structure? We're going to change its function, right? So the function of rough ER is a lot different than smooth ER because the structure is different, right? And then we got a Golgi apparatus here. We see a bunch of microtubules and microfilaments. So I'm going to talk about all these different things. These centrioles control what these microfilaments and microtubules do inside the cell. Let's see what I'm missing. Oh, I see a bunch of bubbles right here. We're going to talk about what some of these bubbles are. Okay, here's one that's called a lysosome. Then we've talked about an endosome already. That's a bubble. But this bubble has a membrane around it, pretty similar to the membrane that surrounds the cell. Lysosome, peroxisome is another kind that we're going to talk about. Okay, so let's start with a plasma membrane. So here's a nice plasma membrane. Let's forget about all these complicating structures, right, and think of it just as a phospholipid bilayer. That's one way to think of a plasma membrane, and it is very fluid. And it doesn't have a whole lot of structure. If we were to put a phospholipid bilayer on a glass of water and jiggle the water, it would undulate and jiggle right on the surface of the water. Okay? And if your cell membranes were made only out of phospholipids and you stood up, guess what would happen? All your membranes would just run out on the floor. Okay? So that's not a very good structure, but it's a good basis to build a biological membrane. And so the next concept of a biological membrane is the fluid mosaic model. So we understand that the membrane is very fluid because of the phospholipid bilayer, but it's also a mosaic because we add a whole bunch of other stuff to it, proteins and carbohydrates and even some more lipids. Here's that phospholipid bilayer, and then we add some cholesterol molecules to it, and that just kind of binds this membrane together, makes it a little bit more sturdy so that when you stand up, it doesn't just run out on the floor on you. So that's the job of this cholesterol. Okay, here are some proteins, and these proteins can be enzymes. They can be channels that will allow things to move from one side of the membrane to the other that normally can't do that, like hydrophilic compounds. And on these microfilaments right here, there could be other microfilaments that attach to it that push and pull the membrane in different shapes to give a cell a particular shape. And what kind of shapes do you know, Bob? Maybe four. I'm thinking of four. Squamous is one. Cuboidal is one. Columnar is another one. Right? So these microtubules can be pushed and pulled so a cell has a certain shape. And then I'm kind of tricking you because what's the third shape or fourth shape that I'm thinking about? You have shapeshifters, right? You have cells that can actually change their shape and crawl around inside your body. And it does that by manipulating these microtubules and pushing and pulling on the membrane, right? And those typically are what we call macrophages. They come from monocytes. A monocyte is a kind of white blood cell. And they're there as part of your immune system. And they're crawling around your body all the time, inside your lungs, looking for junk that doesn't belong in your body. Now, how does a macrophage or a white blood cell know that there's a foreign cell in your body and it should be destroyed? Because there are certain markers on the cell membrane, right? And those could be part protein molecule and part sugar molecules, like what I see right here. And then I see another one over here, and it has a little bit different structure. Here I see just a complex of sugar molecules. Okay, and so cell membranes also have something that we call antigens. And all of your cells have antigens, and the antigens all have the exact same shape. And so that's how all cells in your body know that all cells belong to your unit. If you change the shape of an antigen, then it can't belong to your body. It belongs to some other organism. So if we look at the shape of an antigen on you, compare it to your brother and sister, you're going to find that it's very similar. It's going to be different, but it's going to be very similar, and some might be a whole lot more similar than others. But then if you look at somebody that's not related to you, then the shape of those antigens is going to be much different. And then if we look at antigens, for instance, on a snake or maybe a microorganism, those antigens are going to be even more different. Right? So the shape of these antigens determine... They're just little signposts for what body that cell belongs to. Okay, so we have antigens, we have enzymes, we have channels, we got other kinds of proteins and lipid molecules that stabilize the membrane. And that really describes the fluid mosaic model of a membrane. And when we change the structure of the membrane, then of course we're going to change the function of it. So, enzymes, receptors, I forgot to mention receptors, right? There could be receptors in the membrane. Identity markers, what did we call it? Identity marker? That's an antigen, All right, enzymes, we talked a little bit of when we looked at the G-protein coupled receptor, and we talked a lot about transporters already. Transporters can transport a number of different things. All right, so here's that shapeshifter cell, and we're going to talk about transport once again, not molecular transport, but bulk transport. So here we have, for instance, a bacterium, and this monocyte can actually flow around this bacterium, and you can see it completely surrounding it, but not just in two dimensions, but in all three dimensions, so that it's actually trapped inside of a bubble, and then that bubble breaks away from the plasma membrane, and now you have a vesicle inside the cell with this bacterium in it. So the bacterium has been imported. The bacteria is a solid particle, and when a cell imports a solid particle, we call that phagocytosis. I think maybe I've mentioned that already in this class. Phagocytosis is just a specific kind of endocytosis. Endocytosis is bringing things inside the cell. Another kind of endocytosis is when this vesicle forms and there are no solid particles in it, it's just a solution. And so then we would call that cell drinking or pinocytosis. So phagocytosis and pinocytosis are just different kinds of endocytosis. And this is active transport because you have to push and pull on that membrane via those microtubules, and that requires ATP to do that. So it is active transport. And it's nonspecific. Pinocytosis and phagocytosis is usually nonspecific. Oh, what does that mean, nonspecific? It means the shape of what's ever being engulfed is not important. It really doesn't matter. The cell doesn't recognize it by shape, and it doesn't recognize it by shape because there's no receptor. So if there's a nonspecific intake, that means that there's no receptor that stimulates pinocytosis or endocytosis. Right, we do know now that some kinds of phagocytosis are mediated by receptors on the cell membrane. Okay, so that's just, you just kind of have to remember that. Okay, most cases it's nonspecific, but sometimes it is. Some bacteria are really sneaky. They've learned how to bind to receptors on your cells and then get imported by the machinery of the cell itself to infect that cell. Okay, exocytosis is just the reverse process of endocytosis. You have vesicles inside the cell that contain some kind of product. They move over to the cell membrane, and they just fuse to the cell membrane because the membrane of a vesicle and the membrane of the plasma membrane are just phospholipids, so they can merge together very easily, and they can break apart easily as well. And, you know, I can't remember if I mentioned this in this class or not. Maybe not. And that is, you've probably played with something over the weekend. It was a nice long weekend. That kind of demonstrates how membranes can fuse together very easily. I know you all did this. You had a little hoop, okay, and a bottle of soap fluid, and you dip the hoop in the soap fluid, and then what do you do to have fun? You don't remember doing it. Wow. Okay, you went to a party afterwards. Well, then you wave it in the air, okay, and it forms these bubbles, and they kind of float around, but eventually gravity kind of pulls them to the ground. But every once in a while, two bubbles will bump into each other, and they'll burst, okay? But then again, sometimes when two bubbles bump into each other, what happens? They fuse together, and they become just one big bubble. And that's because the surface film is exactly the same. So the same thing can happen with vesicles inside the cell with the plasma membrane. They're just two bubbles. It's just one bubble inside the other, and the membranes touch, and it just forms just one big bubble or a cell, okay? Surface specializations. When we look at these organelles, I do want you to have at least one important function that each of these organelles performs inside the cell. Okay, so cilia contain microtubules, and they're intermediate in length compared to flagella and microvilli, which also contains microtubules. And the arrangement of microtubules inside a cilia means that they can actually slide past each other and up and down. All right? And when one microtubule slides past another, then one side of the cilia becomes longer, right, and it bends over. And then when it gets pulled back, the cilia goes back to its original position. So cilia like to beat as a result of that. And when these things beat, that causes what? Things to move around. So we call that motility. So the function of cilia is motility. A lot of cells, unicellular organisms, use cilia to actually move around in their environment. We have many, many cells in our body that have cilia, but not for moving around themselves, but to move something over the surface of an epithelium. So there are a number of epithelia that have cilia that are sweeping all the time. And a good example of that, I guess this is a good time to talk about it, your trachea, your windpipe, right, is what? Pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium. It has cilia, and they're beating and sweeping all the time. That epithelium also has goblet cells. And who can tell me what a goblet cell is? It's a secretory cell. It's a unicellular gland. And what does it secrete? mucus. Mucus is kind of sticky, right? It lines your trachea so that when you inhale air, the particles in that air get trapped in that mucus, and some of those particles could be viruses or bacteria or fungi or all kinds of junk, which you don't want in your lungs because your lungs are just a dead-end cavity. When it gets trapped in that mucus, the cilia are then sweeping. Which way do you think they're sweeping, down or up? They're sweeping up, right? Because if they were sweeping down, your lungs would fill up with mucus with all that debris, and that would not be good. All right, and then when that mucus with all that junk goes into your mouth, then what happens? And then you just swallow it down. Okay, you get it out of your lungs. Unless what? And I see some people in here. Unless you're a baseball player, then what can you do? Then you can spit all day long, and nobody cares. Okay. But most of us do have to dispose of it a different way. A flagellum is a lot like a cilium. It has microtubules, and it can flip back and forth. It's found outside the cell, attached to the cell membrane. But it's probably 50 to 100 times longer. And some cells have two, and our cells only have one. And only males have a cell with a flagellum. And it's a special kind of sex cell. It's called a sperm, right? And it's also for motility, but that's an interesting cell, different than a ciliated cell, because it's a cell that can actually move around in its environment, unlike these cells that have cilia, that can only move something over their surface. All right, so what I want you to know about cilia and flagella is motility is their function, just in one word. Microvilli, on the other hand, is not motility. They don't beat, they don't sweep, okay? And what they are, they're just bumps and ridges on the cell surface. So here we have just a normal cell without microvilli. And then here we have another cell, identical cell. I want to make it absolutely identical, that have microvilli on it. So I'm drawing microvilli. They're actually much smaller than that, so it's really packed more with microvilli. All right, and the job of microvilli is to increase the surface area or the dimension of this particular cell. So let's take the cell, grab these corners right here, and just gently stretch it. And guess what? We can't really stretch it very much, all right? But if we take the corner of this cell over here and gently stretch it, guess what happens? It gets really long. It becomes this kind of cell. So what have we done? We've made the length of the cell a lot bigger compared to this one right here, but what? It still fits in the same space. All right, so that's the job of microvilli. And the length of this space right here determines how materials can move across this membrane. As the surface area increases, transport can increase as well. So that's its job. So you find this in the intestines, for instance. So when I say surface area, what I want you to think of surface area is a doorway. I want you to think of it as a doorway. Let's look at this piece of paper right here, 8.5 by 11. What would be the surface area of this piece of paper? You would multiply the lengths, right? 8.5 by 11 inches, and then you could calculate surface area in square inches. That's what would be the surface area of this piece of paper. And if we crinkle it up, the surface area would be the same, but it would fit in a smaller space. All right, let's look at this door over there. Here's a door, and what's the surface area of this door? Let's measure it. I got a ruler right here. What can we do? Here's the width of the door. Oh, look at that. Exactly 1 meter. That's very nice because we want to multiply this by the height of the door. We're just going to multiply it by one. So that's going to be really easy. So what's the height of this door? So it's 1 meter. Okay, I should have a tape measure, but I don't. And then here is exactly 2 meters right here. So what's the surface area of this doorway? It's two. It's exactly two. You know, with some error in measurement, of course, as always. So, now consider another doorway, like a garage door that your car drives through, okay? It has a much bigger surface area. I don't know what it is, maybe 10 times bigger. How many people can fit through this doorway? That's 2 square meters. Maybe 2, 3, something like that. What about your garage door, which the surface area now is much greater? Yeah, 20, 30, 40. So, as the surface area increases, what can you tell me about exchange from inside the building to outside, or from the room to the hallway, or across any kind of membrane? As the surface area increases, exchange increases as well, right? And that's why we have absorption or membrane transport. with these microvilli, because the cell is what? Really a lot longer, but that's only one dimension. It's also a lot longer in the other dimension as well. So that's the job of microvilli. Here I can see some cilia on top of a cell, microtubules inside of it that allow these things to sweep. All right, and we talked about cilia in the trachea, also in reproductive tract. The male gamete, namely sperm, has a flagellum, so it can swim around. The female gamete, which is an egg, doesn't have cilia, doesn't have a flagellum, but it has to move as well. Right, it's got to move from an ovary down into the uterus, and it does that because the fallopian tubes are ciliated, and they're sweeping all the time toward the uterus, so that egg is just trapped in that flow of fluid from down the fallopian tube from an ovary into the uterus. Okay, so cilia are important. Surface specializations, microvilli, we talked about that already. Okay, cytoplasm. Yeah, questions? Sign and sheet is going around someplace, I hope. Not all cells have cilia. All cells have a plasma membrane. All cells have cytoplasm. All cells have genetic material. That's the only good definition that works for a cell. So that first illustration of a cell that I showed you that has all these organelles in it, not every cell has all those organelles. They were just put in there so that we can talk about all of them. Okay, but unfortunately it was still missing, what? Microvilli and cilia and flagella. Okay, so here's a slide that actually says cytoplasm is made out of cytosol and organelles, and that's a nice distinction for you to know. The cytoskeleton is a lattice work of proteins inside the cell, and they're made of microfilaments, microtubules, and even some smaller tubules. And here's a special dye that has been used that is specifically taken up by microtubules, and then when a ultraviolet light is shown on it, it fluoresces this color, and you can actually see all the microtubules throughout the whole cell. Okay, and so here's an illustration of what we see underneath the microscope. So this mitochondria knows that it should be in this location, or has to be in this location, because it is attached to the microtubules inside the cell. Right, so the microtubules position organelles where they should be. And where, for instance, I see some rhepanoplasmic reticulum. And also, there could be a vesicle over here, and for secretion, it has to move to the cell membrane. Well, what it does, it hops a ride on a microtubule, which carries it over to the cell membrane where it fuses. All right, so not only does the cytoskeleton act to give the cell shape and organize organelles inside the cell, but it acts like a railway system inside the cell. But usually a train has how many rails? Two. This kind of railway system has one. And what do we call that? That's a monorail, right? And you've all seen a monorail, probably. You wouldn't have, and if you haven't, you don't have to go too far to see it. Because where is there a monorail? Yeah, Disneyland has a monorail, right? Okay, so think of this as like going to Disneyland when you look inside the cell because of all those microtubules. Okay. So most of these organelles have a membrane around them. Some of them do not. Here are centrioles. They don't have a membrane around them. When they have a membrane around them, like this mitochondria, we say they're membrane-bound organelles. Doesn't mean anything other than that they're surrounded by a membrane. A vesicle is a membrane-bound organelle. It has a membrane around it. Smooth ER, rough ER, Golgi body are membrane-bound organelles, and even the nucleus has a membrane around it, so it's a membrane-bound organelle. So these structures are specifically isolated from the cytoplasm here, or the cytosol, via these membranes. And then you're even going to notice, when you look at this mitochondria, how many membranes do you see? I see two. Yeah, it has two separate membranes, so especially membrane-bound. Okay, and these organelles perform specific functions. Lysosomes. I think I talked about a lysosome. Here's a lysosome. Doesn't really stand out much different from all these other vesicles, but a lysosome contains lysozyme, which is an enzyme. It's a protein. Lysozyme can take a big polymer of a biomolecule and break it down into its building blocks. So it can take a protein and break it down into what? Amino acids. It can take a nucleic acid, like DNA, and break it down to nucleotides, right? It can take a triglyceride and break it down to triglycerides and glycerol. Right, so you should be familiar with all those. And what kind of reaction would it use to break all those polymers down? Okay, it's not synthesizing, it's degrading, which is hydrolysis. It's just the opposite of that, right? So it's hydrolysis. So that's how lysozyme works inside of a lysosome. So a lysosome is an intracellular digestive system. It can digest things. So you're saying, ooh, that could be pretty dangerous. What happens if this membrane loses integrity and it starts to leak, and those enzymes leak out into the cell? Guess what happens? Yeah, the cells get digested when that happens, and then, of course, the cell dies. All right, so that's an important treatment for when somebody's having a heart attack or stroke that is now instituted. We give them membrane stabilizers so that these lysosomes don't break open, and that extends the period where we can treat them effectively. Okay, another kind of vesicle, I don't know if I see it here, is a peroxisome. All right, you can maybe find it on the slide, but if not, just draw an arrow to another vesicle someplace. Peroxisome contains another kind of enzyme called peroxidase, and it's a detoxifier kind of enzyme. It doesn't break macromolecules down, it just detoxifies harmful chemicals that are built up inside the cell, mainly free radicals. All right, it can reduce free radicals so they're no longer dangerous. That's the job of a peroxisome. We talked about endosomes already. What the heck was an endosome? So let's just say, oh, here's an endosome. What does it have? It has special things in the membrane of that vesicle, which normally are absent from the cell membrane, but maybe these things in the endosome will import glucose. And it's important for cells to take up glucose, so when blood glucose is high, this endosome is routed over to the plasma membrane. Those transporters are inserted into the membrane. Now the cell can take up glucose as a result, right? So for an endosome, you would want to say routing of membrane functional units. But routing would be a good word. Lysosome would be digestion. A peroxisome would be detoxification, would be some important key words. All right, I see some other organelles. These centrioles right here are made out of microtubules, but their job is to organize microtubules inside the cell, and then also organize how these other organelles are positioned inside the cell. So this is a coordinating system and a command and control system for how the microtubules work and are arranged inside the cell, which then also determines the cell shape or if the cell shape is going to change. I see two kinds of endoplasmic reticulum. One is smooth, one is rough. The rough one has ribosomes on it. And I think we talked about RNA just a little bit. We talked about some different kinds of RNA. And a ribosome is made out of rRNA. And we said that rRNA is important because it makes the workbench where proteins are made. So the function of rough endoplasmic reticulum is that it can make proteins because it has ribosomes attached to it. And when it makes a protein, it gets placed inside the lattice of the rough endoplasmic reticulum. It doesn't just float around inside the cell. All right, so it's trapped behind these membranes right here. I also see some ribosomes that are not attached to the rough ER, but they're around in the cytoplasm. And guess what the job of these, what we call free ribosomes, is? What's the job of a free ribosome compared to a membrane-bound ribosome? You know what? It's exactly the same thing. Protein synthesis. But the proteins end up in two different spaces. Membrane-bound ribosomes make proteins that end up behind a membrane within a vesicle. Proteins that are made by free ribosomes then can just float around in the cytosol anywhere inside the cell. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. Okay, smooth endoplasmic reticulum, can it make a protein? If you look at that, do you see any ribosomes? No ribosomes. So can it make a protein? It cannot because it doesn't have the workbench in which to make a protein. It doesn't have a ribosome. But its function is synthesis. Right? It can make lipids. Like it can take a triglyceride and take off one fatty acid and glomp on that phosphate group and make a phospholipid out of it. So it can modify lipids. And it can also synthesize lipids. And are lipids important for this cell right here? Yeah, because what is it? What do lipids do? They make all these membranes, right? So it separates the living inside world from the dead outside world. So that lipid is a very important component. So that's the job of smooth endoplasmic reticulum versus rough. And then I see something over here that almost looks like endoplasmic reticulum, but it's not. We call this a Golgi apparatus or Golgi complex. And it is associated with rough endoplasmic reticulum, not so much smooth endoplasmic reticulum. All right, so when these ribosomes in rough ER make a protein trapped inside what we call a cisternae inside the endoplasmic reticulum, we can see that the tips of this reticulum can form a little tube or a vesicle, and then it's going to close and it's going to break away from the rough endoplasmic reticulum, and then the microtubule system is going to bring it over to the Golgi apparatus, and that little bubble of proteins on the inside confused to the Golgi apparatus because they're just the same kind of membrane once again. So now those proteins are inside the Golgi apparatus, and there they're modified. So they can another molecule can be added to it, like a lipid can be added to it, or a carbohydrate can be added to it. So the job of Golgi apparatus is to modify proteins. And then those modified proteins then are repackaged in this little budding vesicle right here, and it pinches off after those proteins have been modified and becomes, okay, inside this vesicle. And maybe some of these things inside this vesicle are detoxifying enzymes or digestive enzymes, but some of these products inside this vesicle might be hormones. And what do you want to do with these hormones? You want to secrete them out of the cell. So then this vesicle moves over to the plasma membrane, fuses with it, and whatever on the inside gets secreted from the cell, right? So that would be a form of exocytosis. So this is what we call, talked about that, not about mitochondria yet. This is what we call the secretory pathway, where products are made by rough ER. They end up into the Golgi apparatus. They're modified, and then they find their way outside the cell via the secretory vesicle. So that's another kind of vesicle, secretory vesicle, if it's going to fuse with the plasma membrane to release its contents to the extracellular space. All right, talked about all those. Now, the next one, I think, is mitochondria. All right, so you got to know what these look like because, is this an exam figure? Anybody look at the study guide yet? Oh, don't tell me. I don't even want to know. I hope so. Okay? Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so here is an exam figure. And you have to know these organelles by their shape, their name, of course. But is this an anatomy class or physiology class? So what do you want to know about all these organs? Not only their shape, but of course their functions as well. So that's why I want you to know these bullet point explanations for what's happening. So this particular figure, I'm not going to ask you something simple like, what is this organelle right here? You're going to say mitochondria for sure, but I want to know what the function is, right? I want to know what the function of rough ER or Golgi or smooth ER or centrioles, right? So let's talk about the function of mitochondria, and it's a fascinating organelle. This mitochondria right here takes up oxygen. It also takes up important molecules like glucose that have a lot of energy in them. It's a nutrient molecule. And because of the machinery inside the mitochondria, it can convert that energy and glucose with the help of oxygen into a lot of ATP. It can convert adenosine diphosphate into adenosine triphosphate. And that ATP then is exported from the mitochondria, and that is the energy currency that's used inside the cell to run all kinds of fancy biochemical reactions that otherwise would not occur, like muscle contraction or thinking a thought or transmitting an electrical impulse down a neuron. All of those things require ATP, or even moving things around inside the cell. So that's the job of mitochondria. It makes ATP, but it needs some substrates, namely oxygen. All right, and it needs ADP and organic phosphate so that they can be joined together. It needs glucose, maybe some other substrates like a fatty acid. And the result is mitochondria make ATP, but there are some other byproducts. There's another byproduct that the cell has to excrete. Fortunately, it can happen very easily by diffusion. What kind of compound am I thinking about? I tell you what, I'll give you a hint. It's a gas. It's another gas. Just like oxygen is a gas, the byproduct of this is what we call respiration. What's the molecule that's also being produced? We'll look at a lot in detail with those reactions, but right now, probably you should know CO2 is being produced, right? So this mitochondria can make a lot of ATP, but it has to have oxygen, and it's got to excrete carbon dioxide in the process. So that's the organelle. This organelle right here is the whole reason why we want to inhale to do what? To get oxygen for that mitochondria, and we want to exhale so that this mitochondria is happy, we get rid of the carbon dioxide that's inside our body. Okay, let's look at this slide of a mitochondria. Here's a nice electron micrograph. Here's an illustration of this electron micrograph. And here's the outer membrane, and then I can see some inner membranes inside of mitochondria. And sometimes we call these the Christie membranes. The inner mitochondrial membrane is the Christie membrane, and the space inside the Christie membrane is what we call the matrix. And the space between the two membranes is just what we call the intermitochondrial space, or intermitochondrial, space. The matrix is the deep inside compartment.
So it's not, it doesn't contain any
kind of... All contains the magical stuff, which we're going to talk about, but not in this chapter. Okay, when we get to more biochemistry, respiratory chapter. Okay, so it does contain some interesting things. All right, but also within the matrix, one of these interesting things is that this mitochondria contains genetic material. Right, so how can we consider this mitochondria? It has a cell membrane, it has genetic material, and it has cytoplasm. What the heck is that? That's a cell. Right, so this mitochondria is actually the remnants of a cell, right? And this is what we call the endosymbiont theory. So this is a theory, and most people recognize the evidence and believe in this theory or understand this to be a theory, that at some point in time, there was a eukaryotic cell without mitochondria, contained a nucleus and all those organelles, and it was anaerobic. It couldn't exist in an oxygen atmosphere very easily. And you know some microorganisms that are like that. And then it got infected by a bacterium that had some enzymes that needed oxygen to work. And as a byproduct of using that oxygen, that bacterium released a lot of ATP. Okay, and that's what we call a symbiosis. Endosymbiosis because, right, it's inside the cell. And what is a symbiosis? Symbiosis is when two organisms live together in proximity to each other, right? Endosymbiont would be actually organisms living inside each other, right? And each organism receives benefit from that association. And as a matter of fact, right now, we couldn't live without these mitochondria inside of our cells. And these mitochondria couldn't even function anymore outside of our cells anymore. All right, so you can understand the benefit to our cells that the mitochondria produces because it's secreting ATP that all living processes need. But why is this mitochondria, why is the mitochondria happy to be inside our cells? What is it getting out of the deal? It's being fed oxygen because what are we doing? We're breathing all the time. It's being fed glucose because what do we like? We like milkshakes, right? So this fit guy's got glucose all the time, right? Plus, right, the inside of your cell is a safe haven, right? It's protected from other kinds of bacteria and viruses that like to infect it, right? So that is the nice symbiotic relationship, right? So, and that produced another life form that we call a true eukaryotic cell. And mitochondria replicate according to their own schedule inside the cell, not when the cell divides, but it divides whenever certain criteria are met. So it actually looks like a bacteria, functions like a bacteria, and has all the components of a cell. So, but it's not really anymore a freestanding life form. It's really dependent on our cells, and our cells are dependent on it. So our eukaryotic cells are not two different kinds of species. It's just one species that has fused together from two separate lines of species. And probably in this class you'll realize that you think you're you, but you're really an ecosystem and a symbiosis with a number of other organisms. All right, so next time I'm going to start with ribosomes. Maybe talk a little bit more about mitochondria. Maybe you could find out what kind of bacteria this really looks like. There's a kind of bacteria that looks like that mitochondria.